Hello and welcome to The Game Is About Glory. I'm your host, Steph, and joining me are Gareth and Milo. Hello, gents.
Good evening.
Hi, Steph.
Hello, chaps. This is a special pod, this one. It really is. We're going to be looking back at an era which perhaps defines Tottenham Hotspur like no other, the 90s, and we're going to be doing so through the excellent new book, Is Gascoigne Going to Have a Crack? Abridged title I'm giving you. It was written by Gareth Dace, who will be joining Milo and I to discuss not just the era itself, but the labour of love that this book has been for him and how he got it across the line without needing Hawkeye technology. This one was a bit more of a Ronnie Rocket, it appears. We'll also look at the week that was, courtesy of Milo, as we always do. But let's settle back, take a deep breath, bringing ourselves into the present moment, which will for the next 40 minutes or so be about ponies, Aussies, Jurgens, owls, and even some of the gross implications of having a sugar daddy in the 90s at White Hart Lane. Even White Hart Lane. I'm so relaxed now. I'm so in the 90s. Gareth, welcome.
Well, thank you very much.
Indeed. You want to kick us off here, Milo, with getting us into the conversation about this wonderful book?
Yeah, go on then. So, I mean, Gareth, do you want to just tell us a little bit about what your book's about? And I think Steph kind of gave the game away a little bit. So, and then kind of why this era means so much to you.
Sure. Yeah, well, yeah, the book is about Spurs in the 90s. And the genesis really of this was the pod that we recorded back in November 2021, where we reminisced about our memories of the 90s. And it sparked a fire in me. So it's a season by season commentary of Spurs through the 90s, starting with the 89-90 season, taking us all the way through to the back end of the 99-2000 season. So yeah, we overlap a little bit in terms of calendar years, but roughly it takes you through the 90s. A bit of an ongoing commentary with some input from some, a player that was part of it, a manager that was part of that period, and lots of observers and spectators and prominent podcasters in, including one very own THFC, Steph, who's initial story when we did the pod a couple of years ago about a goal, an equaliser at Leicester in a completely meaningless end of season game, kind of was the real spark that I needed for it. So really, really pleased to have spoken to so many people who remember the era, and that's what it's about. But why does it mean so much to me? Well, it was my formative years. So I was 9 years old when the 90s start. So it takes me from 9 through to 19. So I grew up a lot in that period as well. And on each chapter, I give an account of how I saw that season. So what it actually meant to me and my personal experiences. But I think the 90s are fascinating. We're in a bit of a 90s nostalgia boom generally at the moment. There's lots of, I guess, 90s comedians. There's lots of 90s shows that you see on TV. 90s music is back in vogue. Just because I think it's that generation. We're about sort of 25, 30 years on.
To your point, Richarlison showed up on the touchline the other week with a 90s pony retro classic. And made Absolutely, it look super cool.
No, he did. I mean, the club have got a big range in retro 90s kits at the moment. You see, I'm wearing one at the moment, which is my favourite one, which is the yellow 92 with the bird poo on the shoulder.
The one that looks like a werewolf has like scratched your shoulder, right? It's like at that one. Yeah.
The very same. Yeah, we wore that for 4 years. So I think that's why the 90s meant so much to me and why it was an era that really resonated. And I've got lots of personal experiences that I could draw on that perhaps no other era could. And I think the 90s is an era that you, from a football perspective, it is a self-contained one as well. The changes in football, forgetting Spurs for the moment, was enormous. So yeah. I would say that football looked more different at the end of the decade than it did from the start, more so than perhaps any other decade in the 20th century and beyond then. But just, the commercialisation of it, First Division becoming the Premier League and so on, the way that we consume the game is really different.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think you got an influx of new fans coming in through that decade as well, not just people who are your age at the beginning of the decade, but Italia 90, I think, captured the kind of English imagination like, a tournament hadn't for a while, maybe. Obviously you got the kicking off the Premier League. Obviously Euro 96 was huge, wasn't it, as well in England. So I think for, English fans, you've got a period there where I think maybe those demographics are changing as well in terms of who's going to football. And yeah, there's big changes, I think, throughout that decade. You're absolutely right. Yeah. Obviously, Sky getting the rights, you know, if you're, you know, pre-Sky, you know, how many times a season could you watch your team on TV? And yeah, I mean, it's just massive change.
And it's important, I think, anyone who did not live through this era to quantify exactly what it's like to watch your team, you know, go through the change of a league structure, the change of a broadcasting structure, and all the baggage and you know, bounty that came with that, which of course is all part of the story of Spurs in the 90s, and as you quite brilliantly write about through the decades. You know, look, what mark do you think the 90s Spurs has left on you? And I mean, you know, talk a little bit. I mean, we've already kind of addressed this, but is there anything else left to say about whether Spurs fans, you know, 90s Spurs fans are a different breed to any other because of going through everything we just talked about?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, I mean, I'll definitely take both of your views on this one, because I think 90s Spurs fans, or those of us that fell in love with Spurs in the 90s, are a fairly hardened bunch. So, Steph, I mean, you lived through the trophy-laden era of the early 80s, didn't you?
I did.
I mean, when I spoke to lots of people, you know, within this book, so I'm thinking of someone like Paul Hawksby on, you know, TalkSport, Pete Abbott, who does the PA announcements at Spurs, good friend, mutual friend Daniel Wynne, for example, or even Julie Welsh, who's written the foreword for me. As people who remember Spurs in the 80s, the 90s is a very, very poor relation, I think. So I think if you're a fan of an era, you know, the 80s, and there'll probably be people listening to this or people who will read it who remember Spurs, in the 60s, even the early 70s. I know there was a relegation at the back end of the 70s, but the early 70s saw lots of trophies as well. Then if you compare it to anyone, and I suspect lots of our listeners will maybe have started following Spurs from about 2010 onwards, where there's almost an expectation that if we're not going to be in the top four, we'll be very, very close to it. But the 90s is smack bang in the middle of that, where apart from the cup win in 1991, our expectations, if you remember that era, Milo, I think you're somewhere near this, aren't you? You started watching Spurs during the mid-80s. I know you remember the 87 team, but probably for you're similar to me that for us, that expectation of Spurs is we're going to be somewhere around the middle of the table. We might have a good player here or there.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the early 80s success, but I remember it probably more. I was very young, so I probably remember it more for the FA Cup songs than actual games themselves, if that makes sense.
And the kind of stuff around it. Yeah. Last time a cup final song really meant something, despite Chris Waddle and Glenn Hoddle's best efforts.
So, I think in terms of kind of what I can remember, rather than maybe kind of secondhand memories, I'm looking at mid-80s onwards. So, yeah, so it's a similar experience. And certainly, I think kind of I was probably hardened by 90s Spurs in the way that I suppose we all were, weren't we? But those were kind of, late 80s, early 90s is my formative Spurs years, I suppose.
I think what's very interesting about we've said there, Gareth, well, there's many interesting things. I mean, we could have a whole other pod about many subjects off that. But when we look back at eras with a little bit of distance and with a little bit of reflection, I think we always tend to balance them out a little bit. So you talk about the 80s, and look, the 80s were absolutely brilliant, right? I mean, I loved it. You know, every week you're going to Wembley, every other week you're winning a cup. It's like, goodness gracious, and you win a European trophy. But, you know, there were the days of, like, you know, John Lacey and Gordon Smith and Ali Dick, and, you know, it wasn't all wine and roses, right? I mean, it wasn't. And sometimes some god-awful performances. I mean, there were in and amongst the magic. And the 90s, I'm going to ask you, as you went through writing this book, and certainly in me reading it, I felt this, but what about you? Did you feel that perhaps it was a little more maligned than was wholly necessary on reflection, having lived through it and now having researched it?
Yeah, well, I think when I first started writing the book, it was very much on the basis of you think things are bad now. Well, you should have been around in the 90s. And it was very much to, not to sort of glorify the failure of the 90s, but just to make people aware of some of the two relegation battles, for instance, that we had and the mediocrity that we sort of found ourselves invested in. But the more I thought about it and the more I wrote about, you know, I realised that it was such a perfect mix. And so to give the book the title, its full heading, it's full title here, Spurs in the 90s, a decade of magic, mayhem and mediocrity. And it really was all those three things in equal measures. But I mean, as Forrest Gump said, you never knew what you were going to get next. That was the problem. You would have that magic team of 91 that was followed by complete mayhem in the ownership of the club. And then you have the magic of the Klinsmann season that's then unfortunately followed up by a couple of years of mediocrity and then mayhem of avoiding relegation and then appointing the absolute antichrist of Tottenham Hotspur as your manager as we hit the back end of the decade.
Of course, I have to say, magic, mayhem and mediocrity. I had thrown an extra M word there, madness. But of course, that was me because that's the way I think. But you brought up those words. I wanted an example from you on what was magic, one item of mayhem, one item of mediocrity.
Okay, well, yeah, the magic was the FA Cup win in 1991 and very specifically the semi-final victory over Arsenal, which, I mean, I still think, and we've had Champions League semi-final last-minute winners since then. We've had other cup wins since then. But for me, you know, Gascoigne's goal, the free kick, and then the win over Arsenal in April 1991 is the magic point of my Spurs supporting career. And, you know, I'll throw that back at you, Steph, as someone who remembers two FA Cups and a UEFA Cup in the early 80s. You know, does that Gascoigne goal, does that live up to those moments?
What a brilliant moment it was. And I think this is where the subjectivity of it all becomes so important. You know, I did not witness that game live, but I did witness Ricky Veer's dribble live. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So for me, the Ricky Veer goal is always going to be, but equally, it would be churlish to ignore just how utterly brilliant, impactful and enormous Paul Gascoigne's free kick was. So again, I think this is why it's such a, you know, such a passion project for you, right? This book is mm-hmm. because that is your, that's your moment. You saw it. I saw it, and I've told this story on the pod before. I saw it on a video that came to me by Federal Express to Northern California. Like, it got there 3 days later, and I watched it with the mighty Barney from Napalm Death on a tour bus. I mean, that was the first time I saw it. Other than that, I'd just been hearing about it, you know, from my mum on the telephone. Oh, my God, like, you know. So, yeah.
I mean, I think about that FA Cup semi-final, and, you know, I echo everything you said, Gareth, on it. But I think when we talk about the mediocrity of the decade, and Steph, but you were saying just before we record, you know, that's kind of mid-90s onwards, more so. But yeah. I think it's because we started the decade with such a great team, with such great players and, you know, such, you know, an important, you know, game and, you know, yeah, performance that everything slides off. And I, you know, I can remember back to that period thinking, oh, you know, we're really going to take off, we're going to, you know, just full of confidence, you know, kind of the blind belief of youth that this was it, and we were fantastic, and it, you know, and it hadn't prepared me for what was coming, you know. And I think that's why yeah. the kind of the mediocrity and the grim bit was a real grind. But I suppose, you know, the flip side of that is that so even when true. Things were really bad, in pretty much every team, we've got a star player. We've got one of the best players in the league in pretty much every team in every year all the way through this decade.
Yeah,
and, yeah. you know, we've got loads of our, you know, our favourite ever Spurs players are playing during this period. It's just that quite often they were surrounded by dross.
I know. And it's so funny. And this book, by the way, folks, there is, I mean, you know, Gareth made mention of that game at Leicester, which he very kindly sent me a clip of that goal, actually, in midweek. And I hadn't seen that goal for something like 10, 12 years. It was, number one, it was a much better goal than I remember. It was 1997 at the old Filbert Street. It was a midweek game. And Teddy flicks a header home in the dying seconds. And yes, I think I did actually see myself running down. I'm not sure. But, you know, we talk about the mediocrity. I mean, there was a 0-0 draw against Everton in 1995, which was absolute pants. I mean, it came and it went, and it wasn't very pleasant, would be the best I would say. And the book does highlight those moments as well. But there is a curious warmth and almost sentimentality about those moments, which makes them endearing. Was that intentional on your part, or do you think it just kind of happened that way as you were writing them?
Well, I mean, it's easy to be nostalgic and romanticise about things when they happen 30 years ago, of course. You know, at the time, it didn't feel quite as warm a moment. But I had to read up on the definition. It sounds daft. Someone's just written a book, but I had to read up on the definition of mediocrity, actually having started the book.
Oh my God. Is this a philosophy pod? Is this what we're going into now?
If it is, I won't do it justice. But I mean, mediocrity in my mind is a very overtly negative thing based on, a really terrible set of outcomes. But actually, mediocrity means it's kind of all right, but it could be a hell of a lot better. And that's where we were. That goal you've described at Leicester there, or in particular that 96-97 season, which is never going to be the top of anyone's list when they reflect on a particular glorious Spurs season. But that one was absolutely the epitome of mediocrity. And the fact that, you were so happy in person, that visceral reaction to go and celebrate that we'd got a 1-1 draw at Leicester in a result that we would have started
minute.
The evening in ninth position, and we would have ended the position in ninth position, and we ended the season in ninth position.
Oh my God,
and whether
brilliant.
Teddy scored that goal or not, it would have made absolutely no difference, because that's where we were as a club at the time. We were in ninth position. You spent months and months of the season thinking, win our next two games, we'll be within striking distance of getting into seventh. And that was what supporting Spurs was.
Mediocrity is not a crime. It's a subheading.
But I do think, though, that when you're shit, I mean, not really shit, but kind of...
Mediocre,
I think as fans, you almost have to make your own entertainment, don't you? Mm-hmm. And that's where kind of the cult heroes come through. Yeah. That's where the funny songs come through. Or that's where the oddities, the peculiarities, and that's kind of... I think that's more club that forms your identity, maybe more than success. Yeah. And when you're pushing for the top, you actually your nerves are worse, aren't they? Almost because we've got years in the middle here, where our season was over before Easter, and we've got nothing to play for.
That's it. Yeah.
And
so true. No, it's so true. Yeah.
It was as soon as we got knocked out of the second cup competition, wasn't it? That was the end of the season.
Yeah.
Whether that was January or April, that was the end of the season.
Yeah, yeah. I think just to take a break for a moment, and we're most certainly going to get back into the more content-based elements of this book, not the least of which is you getting together with Jerry Francis and David Howells. We will get there. But if I can get practical with you for a moment, it's one thing for a midweek last minute goal at Leicester to motivate someone to want to write a book about a decade. It's quite another thing to actually do the book and get it done and physically write the words and physically go out there and make it work. An idea is easy. The execution of an idea is very hard. The fulfillment of an idea is very rare. So I'm really intrigued, and I think Milo, I speak for both of us, am I right? I mean, we're both really intrigued to know, if you want, from farm to table, if you can bring us through the practical stages of becoming a soon-to-be published author of a book with quite possibly the best cover of any Tottenham Hotspur book I've ever seen.
Yeah. Well, I guess the book was always in my mind and had been for many years. And in fact, somewhere in my parents' loft, there is a box with some floppy disks in it of some paragraphs I'd put together probably about 20 years ago when I first thought about this sort of project. Anyway, I mean, that hasn't seen light of day for a long time. I just wouldn't have had access to, I think, all the bits of information that I needed this time around to do it. But I can pretty much pinpoint almost to the minute when this started. So the seed was sown when we ran the podcast back in November 2021. But then I think really it was totally out of therapeutic purposes. So I'm going to say it started at probably about 1:48 p.m. on Saturday, the 1st of October 2022. And that was because that was the moment that Emerson Royale was sent off in the North London Derby at Highbury. We were already 2-1 down. I just had the hum. Milo, you often talk in your household that you have to tell your wife that it's going to be a grumpy game, which I'm sure that would have been just as much for you as it was for me. Yeah. That was a grumpy game. Rather than swearing at the TV in front of my kids and wife for the next half hour, I thought, I'm just going to go back. I'm going to think about what it was like supporting Spurs in the 90s. I took my laptop up with me. So whilst the final half hour of the current 2022 iteration of the North London Derby was taking place, I just started typing some things, just citing some memories down, thinking, well, I'll get bored of this after a sentence. And a sentence became a paragraph, and a paragraph became three or four paragraphs. And probably by 4 o'clock that afternoon, I had the basis of my first chapter and introduction.
You got infected. Written. You were infected by it, right? It just took over you like a virus. Yeah.
Yeah. And it I got into flow state. So I would just find time, whether it was first thing in the morning, whether it was at a, whether it was a weekend, whether it was of an evening. I just found time that I would start putting these paragraphs together, and I thought, actually, this kind of reads okay to me. So I was doing this without a publisher in mind.
So waking up in the mornings, just first thing, dreaming of Ginola's magnificent balls, straight to the laptop, right? I mean, that's
straight to it. Yeah, yeah, all that sort of thing. And then I started to, I spoke to people like you who had very visceral memories of particular things. I was able to talk to a good friend of mine, Daniel Wynn, who has got lots of memories himself. He was able to open up a few contacts for me as well. And the best thing was he has kept every home match day program for about the last 60 or 70 years. So when I wanted to find out how much the supporters club had to pay to charter a flight to Zimbrew in 1999 for UEFA Cup tie, he could go to page 36 of that program, send me a picture of it, and bang, I had that information in front of me. So so I guess through those
contacts... How much was it? Well, I guess we look in the book, don't we?
You have to find out in the book. Yeah, absolutely. Right. Yeah. Well, not because I don't remember, but I want people to buy the book.
Good.
If we're giving away information like how much it costs to fly to Chisnau in 1999, we'd be giving it all away. So
that's right.
I think it just snowballed a little bit, really. It took me about 4 months to write the first draft of the manuscript, which was just shy of that 90,000 words.
Incredible pace. That's a great pace.
It just happened very, very naturally. I didn't have to force myself at any point to continue going with it. So then the hard bit was then finding a publisher. So I contacted various publishers, but my hope was always Pitch Publishing, who, kind of spoiler alert, were the publishers who came back to me and said they were interested in the project. So I didn't hear from them. I think I submitted something to them in about the February, and it was the first week of May.
2023, we're talking about.
2023, yep. That they came back and said, yep, it was something they were interested in. I didn't really believe it at the time. I thought, well, kind of how much further do I have to go down the line before they say, actually, no, we're not interested in it anymore. But no, they've been very, very good with me. They have a huge array of sports books. They really do churn out a lot of books, a lot of which I've got on my shelf. There's a lot of Spurs books that I've already purchased and and read. But yeah, they've been very, very good with me. And there was that May last year, we got into the formal stage of signing contracts. And at that point, I was able to speak with Julie Welsh, who's written the biography of Tottenham Hotspur, and I'm sure many people will have heard her speak. And she was a great voice, really, to bring to the table, just because
Dame Julie Welsh, should say.
Colloquially, she is. I did check that with her. She's known as, she's not a dame, but
she's a dame to Dame Julie Welsh in the Tottenham Hotspur pantheon.
Absolutely,
of history.
Yeah. Mm. No, of course she is. Of course she's Spurs royalty. And having written the biography of the club, she's so in tune with everything that happened, and she was able to reflect on what the 90s meant to her, which was really helpful, because she sees it in that far wider context of having written about the club from inception back in to 1882.
At what point, Gareth, did you start reaching out to, we talked about Judy then, but Jerry Francis, David Howells, other ex-players and stuff like that, was that before you had a publisher, or did you have a first draft of it and then get the publishing deal and then start reaching out to those people?
So David Howells was a little bit earlier on in the process. So that was through two mutual connections that I was put in touch with him. But he was very happy to speak with me, and he was the first name on my list just because he played for Spurs from mid 80s, but he carried on. He was still with us till 1998, so he saw pretty much everything. It's only about an 18 month period right at the end that he wasn't about for. I've heard him speak as well, so I knew that he was be very candid, and that he could reflect on matters that occurred. Jerry Francis was much later. In fact, I'd already signed the contract with Pitch, so He came through. So I'll name check someone else who was very, very helpful for me. He's a fellow called Chris Slegg, who is a BBC journalist. And Chris wrote a fantastic book, which if you're going to buy another book about Spurs on the year, buy his one. It's called The Team That Dared to Do. And it's all about the 94-95 season in which Jerry Francis became the manager in the November. Badger. And it's a book. It's Jerry Francis had written a diary of that whole season, starting from when he was at QPR. He was never anticipating leaving QPR, and he came to Spurs. So he'd written this diary, and it never saw light of day. Anyway, I think Chris found out that Jerry had written this diary and decided he would sort of do the wraparound bit. So between them, they pulled this book together that was released in about 2017. So, I mean, I just contacted Chris Legg through LinkedIn, and I've tried to contact a lot of people through LinkedIn and through other sources who just never got back to me. But Chris did, and he, I think, spoke through the process of the book, because his one was also with Pitch Publishing. And he contributed a little bit to the book as well. He shared some of his memories of that season and what it was like writing that book about that year. And then really right at the end, I thought, I've got David Howells. I've got lots of secondhand players' accounts because I've got so many books. So I went out and bought Irving Scholar's book, Alan Sugar's book, Terry Venables' book, Ginola's book, Sol Campbell's book, Teddy's book, Neil Ruddock's book. So I had all these secondhand accounts, but I thought, I think I need another first-hand account. So I just asked Chris. I said, look, would you mind putting me in touch with Jerry Francis? Do you think he'd be interested? And he came back to me and he said, well, yeah, he said, here's his number. Give him a call. And Jerry was incredibly generous with his time. We probably spent 3 or 4 hours in total speaking.
Fantastic.
And, yeah.
That's just brilliant, isn't it, Milo? The Badger giving three or four hours of his time. Wonderful. And I mean, first of all, as well, I've got to say, love hearing stories about fellow writers helping each other. Chris sounds like a top man, and I you know, you're what you said there about you try and reach out to people through LinkedIn and you don't usually hear, you know, and it's, and Chris obviously established in his own right, happy to join in and help. Love that. And I love the fact that you told us about his book, because frankly, until this moment, I did not know about it. And now I'm going to add that to my list of books to purchase, with yours already being on my pre-order. But that's wonderful. 3 or 4 hours. Do you go to his house? Do you have tea? Do you serve him tea? I mean, give us the nitty gritty details, because we'll read what you talked about, but I want to know about the setting. Give us the setting.
No, it was all over the phone. I mean, he's a man in his 70s now, but what really struck me is that I rang him on it. It was a landline number, which is probably telling of his age there, that you got someone's landline number. But he was very meticulous. I mean, Jerry's a very, very proud man, as absolutely he should be. He captained England, of course.
Yes.
I certainly got the sense that he felt that he had been, I think, underappreciated, not necessarily by Spurs fans. He said he had a good relationship with Spurs fans, but I think he feels that his time there was, I think the first two seasons were very good, and then he kind of had the rug pulled from under his feet, and you know, people can read the content of that, or we can discuss that. But I felt not so much he really wanted to put the record straight, but I think he's got a lot that he wanted to get off his chest about his time at Spurs and just how difficult it was for him as a Spurs manager in the mid to late 90s. But yeah, all the conversations were on the phone. I would then type up what he had told me, so I'd ask him specific questions. He would gave me incredibly detailed responses and memories of what happened. Then I would type it up, email it to him. He'd look over it and he'd say, happy with that one, but no, I'd like you to reword that bit, and that bit's not quite right, can we have another go at that?
You love that level of dedication. I mean, that's a step above just getting a sort of a celebrity guest to give you a few quotes for your book. He's working with you on it. Hats off to Jerry Francis for that. Wonderful.
And it's great stuff. It certainly changed my perception of Jerry Francis' role and successes as our manager. Because I've looked for kind of full transparency here. For me, when I think about the mediocrity, I'm very much thinking about his time as manager. But actually, through having the conversation with him, say that the rug was really pulled under his feet. And I mean, he reeled off stat after stat after stat of the things that he'd achieved.
And yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, when you look at 90s Spurs, obviously we're talking about, yeah, Alan Sugar's, it's his decade. He buys the club at the beginning of the decade. He sells the club at the end of the decade. And yeah, there's a period where there's money coming into the league from the formation of the Premier League. There's a huge changes in football. You know, Arsene Wenger joins Arsenal, and you know, his approach to nutrition and health and all that kind of stuff is completely revolutionary. We start the decade as one of the biggest clubs in the league. We're competing. You know, we've got great players. And I think, you know, the story of the decade is that there's all these changes going on, and we're tightening the belt, and we're looking, you know, smaller areas when other clubs are looking, you know, out, you know, wide. They're broadening their horizons. They've got bigger ideas, and we're getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And that's what's sad for me, because the decade starts so brightly, and you know, obviously Sugar saved us. You know, it could have been Robert Maxwell. It could have been a lot worse. Yeah. But you know, the way he manages us through that decade is also kind of, you can see the results on the pitch. You can see what happens.
I think it's also, I mean, one of the things, even just as we're talking about this era now, and we're talking about Gerry Francis in particular, I think what you said about Gerry's era is interesting, because to me, it was the best of times and the worst of times. I mean, that first season is absolute, well, the season he comes in for Aussie, absolutely brilliant. And then you wonder, and this is an off-the-cuff question for both of you. I mean, do you think maybe our 90s turns on the FA's decision to give us one stand at Elland Road and allow Everton to have three and surround the pitch and absolutely just completely change the atmosphere and dynamic of a semi-final that I think we had the better team and I think everyone expected us to cakewalk? But then you going, you know, that game, the atmosphere was bizarre, because we were all in that one stand, and it really felt like we'd been kind of fucked over by the FA. You do wonder, I mean, is that a dynamic that changes everything? I don't know. Have either of you ever thought about that?
Yeah, well, I covered it in the book, because it was such a talking point, you know, specifically that issue of the first time a semi-final being played at Elland Road in 30-odd years. So it was, what I didn't know, this was one of the insights I got from Gerry Francis, the Spurs, Everton and the FA were in some really heated rows. And if Gerry Francis said it was a heated row, it was a heated row, because he's a man who knows a thing or two about having a heated row. Many of them he had between him and Alan Shearer. But he said they could not understand why the semi-finals weren't played at Wembley, because they'd been played, forget whether you think they should or shouldn't be. In 1993, both semi-finals were played at Wembley. The following year, 94, both were played at Wembley. So the expectation was, well, in 1995, particularly when you got two huge clubs like Spurs and Everton who would definitely sell out an allocation at Wembley, you know, why are they then being taken back into the provinces? Now, the purists might argue, well, they should still be played at neutral grounds. They shouldn't be played at Wembley. But they just couldn't understand, you know, why it wasn't being played there. And they couldn't understand why we had one side of the ground and Everton had three, even if nominally there was the same number of fans within there. Hearing different players' perspectives on it, some of them think it was a big issue, but others of them didn't see it being an issue at all. So I mean, I guess that's interesting. But Gerry, if you think back to that time, I mean, you guys will definitely remember this. And Steph, you were obviously at Anfield for the quarterfinal beforehand, but people said Spurs' name was on the cup that year, because we weren't even in the cup at the start of the year. We'd been banned from it. So to give it its full chronology. People said our name was on the cup, and you know, Gerry was very clear. He was really, really very, very uncomfortable about that. He didn't necessarily say that the players all believed that it was on it, but he was very clear to try and avoid that complacency. But I mean, the omens were, this was a great thing that I found out actually. The day before that semi-final, the Grand National took place at Aintree, and it was won by a 40-1 outsider called Royal something. I forget the name of it. It's in the book, but the name of the horse that won it, 40-1 was I'm going to say Royal Athlete.
This is as close as you will personally ever get to lemons and auras, isn't it? Mm. Welcome to my world.
Yeah. But just to round off on Gerry Francis. There was always the perception at the time that he was it Napoleon who was described as a good general but not a lucky one, or but there was always this feeling that Gerry Francis was a good general but he wasn't a lucky one, and it was things like that. It was things like at the end of that season, Klinsmann activating this clause that Sugar had forgotten had been written in the contract that he could leave after a year. There was Nick Barmby getting homesick and moving up north. There was Popescu deciding that he'd had enough of English football and wanted to go to Barcelona. There was then Chris Armstrong coming in, having a really, really good first season, and then buggering up his ankle within weeks of the following season and never really returning. There was Darren Anderton's perpetual injury problems at the club.
Don't give it all away. I hope people are scrambling for their pre-order links, because I mean that you do get into all of this, and it's fantastic and really detailed. And there you're even the things you're saying, so many memories, it triggers so many memories. So I think one aspect of the book that fascinated us as well, you expressed how certain personalities dominated the era despite being fabric in our greater history, which I think is a really interesting phrase. What I'm interested in is, can you now name, you know, a few that survived the decades and are legends? I mean, I think it's fairly obvious. So beyond the obvious names that you're welcome to list, are there a couple that maybe we need to give a little, you know, attach a little more respect to their names, so to speak?
The obvious, the headline names are, I guess, Gascoigne, Klinsmann, Ginola, which take you through. And they are all from different teams, really. I know Klinsmann came back and played with Ginola for a little bit, but they're fundamentally of different parts of that era. But, I mean, it's as much as what was going on in the boardroom as anything else. So, you know, Alan Sugar is very much the leading protagonist throughout the decade. But I think it's a chance to remember Terry Venables, who I've eulogised about before, and the impact that he's had on the club. So, I mean, winning the FA Cup as manager in 1991, he's still the only person in the club's history who's won the FA Cup as both a player and as a manager. There's those players that just weave everything together a little bit, really. So, you know, Teddy Sheringham comes in after the cup final team. He takes us through that Klinsmann era, and quite understandably, he gets pissed off and clears off just as Ginola comes in. So we never get to see the two of them in the same team. Then you've got, I've got to mention David Howells as well. It's just that constant throughout that period. So as Gary Mabbutt was, although he's maybe more he's more memorable for the 80s, I would have said, than the 90s. And then Darren Anderton, who again I think was the supporting act, wasn't he? He was the supporting act to Teddy. He was the supporting act to Klinsmann. Really, he was the supporting act to Ginola, who played on the other wing at that time. But in another era, Darren Anderton would have been remembered as one of our best ever players.
Well, talk about that. Yeah, Milo, go on. You were going to say
something.
I was just
going to say on Anderton, I think he's another one who gets a bit unfairly labelled, that sick tag. The sick note tag that was labelled on him. You know, up until a couple of seasons ago, he was our record appearance holder in the Premier League. You know, it was only when Lloris went past him two, three seasons ago. wasn't that long ago. Certainly during the lifetime of this pod. And for a player who was, I mean, I was kind of amazed that the baggage didn't weigh him down, because he was a great player. And I think, lesser players would have really struggled with that.
I completely agree, and it's so funny that you were coming in to talk about him, because I was going to drag you into asking anyway. So he really is such a definitive point of many things we're talking about, in terms of living through what you thought was the reality of who he was and everything. And then you give a little perspective, you take a little breath, you look back, and it's like, my God, this guy's assist record in modern parlance is incredible. He had a great international reputation and appearance record. Everything you just said, Milo, it's like our perceptions of him are so, at that time, were very unfair. And then you look back and you're like, crikey, what a player. And maybe he also didn't get the respect he deserved. It's funny, I've talked to him a couple of times in the last decade. I've never got the feeling he's bitter about it. He seems very relaxed and very calm about the fact that he didn't get the respect that his talent and his appearance record deserved. But you know, you're right. What an interesting example of 90s Tottenham. I mean, he really is, isn't he?
Yeah, and he's top man, and he reposted my tweets about the book as well.
Great. Yeah.
Good he's man.
I mean, and he does love the club. I mean, he does. Yeah, he does. Yeah, very, very much so. I'm interested to know, we're interested to know, your first technical live moment of 90s Tottenham and then your last technical live moment. I mean, in a stadium.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
What were they?
So my first one was an FA Cup defeat to Southampton on the 6th of January. So it's the day after my ninth birthday in 1990. It was a bit of a smash and grab, actually. If you find footage of it, it was Bobby Mims' last ever game, the Spurs goalie. I think Eric the Viking was injured, so he'd come in for a couple of games. What he's doing for Barry Horn's second goal, goodness only knows. But we lost that one 3-1. My memory of that day, though, was spending my birthday money on the new or home socks, which cost me £5.50, and I hope would be en route to completing the whole kit, but alas, it never happened. That was the Hubble kit.
You mean your parents, you were expecting to get the kit for your birthday, and they didn't?
It didn't. That one didn't happen. I got everyone bar that one.
So you had a pair of socks out of your own money and God dear.
That's it. Never going to get more than that.
Do they know that? Will this be the first time they've ever actually heard you tell that story, that they let you down?
They heard a lot about it at the time.
Very good.
But to be fair, I was probably the first kid in my school with the full Umbro kit that came out the following year. So
excellent.
Swings and roundabouts. And then my...
swings and roundabouts from socks to the full kit wanker in less than a year. Brilliant.
In less than a year.
I still am a full kit wanker, so I'm not making fun of you. Don't worry.
And then my last life experience of Spurs in the decade was Boxing Day 1999, Spurs 4, Watford 0. It was a Ginola masterclass. I think he scored once and two assists. I was sitting in the East Lower for that game. And that was, say, very much of its time. It was Ginola in a home game, just absolutely bossing it.
Brilliant.
So Bobby Mims to David Ginola in a decade.
Very good.
We'll go there in a minute. Go on, just one last question on this. So if you could pick one 90s player who you think would improve the current team, who'd you go for and why?
I'm going to go with the obvious one and say that Gascoigne as we remember him in that period, either side of the World Cup leading up to that FA Cup final for us, just because he was just so incredible as a player that you could put him into, I think, any midfield and he would improve it, just because he had the capability to do probably what three individual players could do. He just had it all.
I think Steph would probably pick him just to get me to shut up about 1v1 players and being able to take on and beat a man. Him in the Madison role would be great, wouldn't it? It would.
Yeah.
You know, he'd be fantastic, wouldn't he?
Yeah. I think you could play
him in the same team as Madison. That's a little bit mental, isn't it? It's not really going to work.
Steady,
but anyway.
And Steph, who would you go for?
Are you going to go for the same? Well,
David Tuttle.
It could be a controversial choice, what I'm going to say, but no, I'm not going to go there. I think I'm going to have to agree with Paul Gascoigne, because he was such a generational talent. I mean, he's probably the closest this country has ever got to producing a Maradona, you know, in the sense of someone who can really, really just, he can make it all happen around him. And why, when you've had a player like that, would you not have him again in his prime?
Yeah, absolutely.
So
I think Klinsmann or Lineker would score for fun in an Ange team that's working really well, in that he wants a striker who can occupy the box. I think Lineker particularly, his kind of speed in the box would be electric, and just, you know, his ability to find the minutest bit of space and put a ball away would work really well, I think, in this team.
Yeah. It's tough. I mean, Teddy, obviously, it is Gazza. I mean, Teddy's for me, was a beautiful player, just wonderful. I mean, just such touch, really intelligent. But in today's game, in Ange's side, he's probably not an Ange player, although you'd always find room for him, I suppose, maybe as a 10, I don't know. But Gazza does edge it. And if you were pushing me for a second, which, go on then, you can push me for a second. Nobody's pushed me for a second. I'm pushing it out there. I would say Teddy. And Milo, you're saying Gazza, right? I mean,
I'd say Gazza. I think Lineker, but just because of that box presence, I think, would be really, really good. Ange doesn't want his strikers touching the ball too much. He wants them finding space in the box and putting away chances, which, you know, he's possibly the best, you know, one of the best ever at doing that. So
yeah,
I think he'd score a shitload for us.
Yeah. Right. All right. Who wants to lead us through this next little bit that we've got?
Shall I go for it then? So we're going to establish that 90s Spurs is a decade of highs and lows with some great players and a fair bit of dross. What's our best Spurs team from the 90s? Who are we going to put in goal?
Well, why don't we let Gareth, seeing as we're talking about Gareth's wonderful book, should we let Gareth lead on all these positions?
And so then you can go and first and then we can pick it apart and tell him where he's got it wrong. Okay, fantastic. I'm in this. Excellent.
Fantastic.
We've had 45 minutes licking his ass about his book. Now let's get to the real stuff.
Now let's pick him apart. Well spotted.
Yeah, right, well go. Go on.
Sure. Okay, so in goal for me, it's Eric the Viking. Although, yeah. I mean, I do look back some of the goals he conceded now and think technically that was probably a bad one to concede. But I think that's just because goalkeeping and goalkeeping coaching has come on so much in 30 years. But he kind of had it already. He had the height, didn't he? He was, 6'4". I remember being mesmerised the fact he was 6'4". And that and that was the height I wanted to become. Because of Eric Tortsvet. But he became a new
socks, trying to touch the top of the kitchen door frame, right? Yeah. Stretching.
Yeah. Yeah. So for me, it's him. I suppose Ian Walker played more games than him during the era. I think it's a credible mention for Aspen Barton. I think he was a very good goalkeeper and perhaps never really got the opportunities that he maybe should have done. And if we don't go for any of those three, it's Bobby Mims, who was Booby Mims.
Mm. I think we might have a place for him in the other team. Steph, who are you going for?
Well, it's a tough call. I went for Eric the Viking, but my heart went with Espen Barton because I think that he was a brilliant goalkeeper. And I have some personal reasons where I would pick him as my number one. But holistically speaking, it has to be Eric the Viking.
Yeah, no disagreement from me. Who are we putting at left back? Go on, Gareth.
So at left back, I went for, I think largely for nostalgia, I put the late, great Justin Edinburgh inside, who's our most decorated player of the decade, having won both the FA Cup in 91 and the League Cup in 99. I think with better players around him at the right times, he could have gone on to be remembered technically sort of better way than he was.
I've gone for him as well. He's an ever-present through the decade as well, isn't he?
He is, yeah. Yeah, he plays in every calendar year. He's the only person who played for us in every calendar year.
I found this very tough because with both Edinburgh and Austin, I have very soft spots for them. I think they were both much maligned. But I actually went for Pat Vandenhout just because I thought, crikey, no nonsense from him. Obviously, I'm outvoted anyway, and I think that Justin Edinburgh, having played pretty much a whole decade, it is his spot. But my word, I would have liked to have seen Pat Vandenhout. So anyway, Justin Edinburgh we are going to go with, right?
Yeah. Great. Should we do both centre-backs together? You got two down there for us, Gareth?
Sure, yeah. So I have. And so the beauty of writing this book is that I could quite neatly bookend it from the 1st of August 1989 through to the
justification coming up
May 2000.
He's squirming.
I can't therefore not have Sol Campbell in our team, who became a... Because as far as this book is concerned, history stops on the 31st of May 2000. So purely on that basis, I think he's got to be in there. And my challenge was, who did I put him alongside? So Gary Mabbutt was our captain for much of the 90s, was part of the 91 Cup winning team. I still think his perhaps better days when he was a truly outstanding player were in the 80s. So I'm sort of torn between whether I put Neil Ruddock in there alongside Campbell. And this was the Neil Ruddock that we had in the 92-93 season. We talk about, and we may talking about ball playing left-sided defenders again as well. But he was so good for us that year. He really sorted out all of his disciplinary problems. Of course, pace wasn't as much of a thing back then. But before he left us because of the mayhem of the Venables Sugar fallout.
I remember.
But he was very much knocking on the door of the England call-up when that really meant something.
I believe Mrs. Ruddock at that time was knocking on the gates of Alan Sugar's house protesting, wasn't she, if I remember correctly?
So we've heard Gareth's choices. Steph, what's the right choice?
Oh, I couldn't believe that Gareth said Sol Campbell. I just couldn't believe it because, quite frankly, hiding behind Gareth as I am, I also named him. I have to be honest, because like it or not, he was a fucking great centre-half for us. He was brilliant. No, he was. He was a brilliant player. I saw him make his debut. He's brilliant. That's why it hurt so much. That's why what he did hurt so much. It really did. And it was still, for me, the biggest act of traitorism that's ever been seen in modern football. So I went for that, and I actually went for Gary Mabbutt on the basis of experience. Even though he's not a natural left footer, obviously, but he could play on that side of the two. And I sort of felt as well, you know, if you got Pat Vandenhout outside, you just fucking taking out anything that you don't get, maybe it'd be okay. So I went with Campbell and Mabbott. So that was my are you going to restore some you know, some sort of psychological order here, Milo, or are you going to
I'm not sure about that. I mean, I'm very tempted just to say fuck you both and walk off. Like, I can't even believe we're talking about putting him in. I mean,
really? I mean, aside from the fact that he twatted us over big time and we all hate him for it, as a purely football-based decision, do you really find it that hard? I mean, honestly, I'm asking.
I mean, I'd pick Chris Perry over him. I mean, I just think his behaviour invalidates him from being a part of any Spurs team. I mean, he's undoubtedly a great player. You know, all that's true. But, yeah.
So, I think, in fairness, I don't think anybody would disagree with you on that. But I think, surely, I mean, you know, if this is a football decision. I mean,
my decision is based on football. It's just.
Yeah. Well, Chris Perry's not as good as Sol Campbell, but I understand what you're doing. I understand what you're saying. But so, who would you have picked? Who's written down on your little piece of paper? We've all got our pieces of paper. Who's written in yours?
Well, I've gone for Mabbott as well. I mean, so. I mean, we're going for Mabbott and Campbell. Ugh.
Who else did you have other than Sol? Did you have Chris Perry? Did you have?
Yeah, I did, because, I mean, he's not great, is he? He's not, but he was solid, and it's tough. I mean,
he's a fish finger sandwich of a centre back, really, isn't he? I mean, he's unspectacular. He'll get the job done, but he's not exactly going to win you any gourmet awards, is he?
He was too short, wasn't he?
You know, yeah. Well,
Ruddock's an interesting one, isn't he? Because any period later, he never would have made the top flight, would he? I mean, his physical condition, just he wouldn't be able to play in the modern game. And I'm a bit stung, right? So some friends of mine live in a house that he used to own, and I can't say any more than that, really. But
well, I'll ask you: does it still have walls in between the you know, the foundational pillars? I'll ask you that: is it still standing? So, well, I don't know. Should we come to a spiritual impasse here and say, why don't we, for the sake of our own respectability as a pod, you know, in terms of reputation, say Ruddock and Mabbott, but really the truth must be that Gareth and I did vote for Sol Campbell on the football basis that he is brilliant.
Or Gary Mabbott and redacted. We'll do that.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
I like that. Redacted. Very good. All right.
Right back.
We haven't even got past right back yet. Ready? How
come? Right
back, I think it's a fairly straightforward one. Steve Carr for me.
Same.
Not only did he come through our youth system yet, he was such a good right back yet.
All right then. I think this one might be quite easy as well. Left wing.
Ginola.
Yes.
Yep. A central midfield.
So for me, it's obviously Gascoigne, who I'm assuming we've all got in there. And then I've gone for, though he's a one-season wonder, Gica Popescu, who was definitely the most talented foil that we had in there. We only had him for one season, of course.
I was tempted by him too. But
I think with him, he's not a great Spurs player, but he's probably one of the great midfielders that we had that decade. It's just that his best was elsewhere.
Well, he scored the winner against Arsenal.
He did. Yep. I remember it well. Yes.
Who did you go for? Who was your other central midfielder?
This was the choice that I didn't think anybody else would have. I picked Paul Allen because I think he would. I think his counterbalance against the players that we're inevitably going to pick, I think, would have been perfect. And I think I had Popescu actually written in, and then I just looked and I thought, it's a little too beautiful. And so I tried to think functionally, like a manager. And I thought of Paul Allen, another person who scored a winner in a North London derby, actually. Mm-hmm. I just thought he'd be perfect in that side. Him and Gascoigne together, I think, really, really good. Really good little partnership.
I went for David Howells because I really like him.
Very acceptable.
Yeah,
I liked him as well. It's tough, wasn't it?
I mean, I'd say I thought about Popescu as well. So does that mean it's Popescu because Gareth put him down and we both thought of him?
Or does it mean that Gareth gets to pick because we're promoting his book, or have we done enough ass kissing? No. Which is it?
Well, no, to be fair, I think David Howell should go in there because he contributed so nicely to the book in the first place. And he did play alongside Gascoigne in the 91.
Very nice.
Well.
So Gascoigne and Howells.
Yeah. I'd name subs of which both Howells and Paul Allen were on, actually. So, but Howells, yeah, he can go in there for his longevity. And
okay.
And I think right wing we're all going to agree on as well, aren't we?
We've all spoken about, haven't we, Darren Anderton?
Correct. Yep. Yes. What a midfield. Fucking hell, what a midfield. My God. I mean, and let's face it, the forwards must be... Well, there's an outlier in the forwards, actually. There is an outlier. This is going to be... Go on.
Go on, who are we going for then?
Yeah, well, the three that I've got, and I've... Sheringham, I can only pick two. But yes. The three, it's two from Sheringham, Lineker and Klinsmann.
Yeah.
Well, and who's your two?
I've gone for Teddy because I think whichever of the other two he would link up with and he would complement. So for me, it's Teddy and it's, I think it's Lineker.
I agree.
It could so easily be Klinsmann.
All right. I picked Klinsmann and probably based on the fact that I saw the two of them link so well so many times in such a short amount of time. But you know, what a spoiled there, aren't we, really? So.
I went for Lineker. His goal scoring record is a bit better, and he hung around for more than a season and a half.
Mm. I mean, in fairness to Jürgen, he did come back and help bail us out. But I think there can be no arguing when you're arguing two of three, and those are the three. I mean, it's really this churlish to argue, isn't it? So, so we've established that it's Sheringham and Lineker, right?
Yeah. Great. I think. You've mentioned a couple of subs. I think Nicky Barmby's unlucky to be missing out, I think.
Correct. Agreed.
I think he'd certainly be making the bench.
Yes.
Jürgen's on the bench. That's not bad, is it? Teddy and Lineker are tired after 70 minutes. We bring on Barmby and Klinsmann. That'd be all right.
Yeah, he'll do.
Yeah. I am Popescu on my bench. Yeah. I mean, it feels like we're all in the same range, actually, which is really good. I mean, I was a little surprised that we're all... as close as we are. I mean, but I think what's fascinating for me when I was going through this exercise is, you know, you've got players like Chris Armstrong, who, as you said, had a pretty decent goal scoring record. There's a lot of players in and around there who just, you can't find room for them. So they're not there. And it's not like they weren't good. It's just like they weren't good enough. I mean, we were kind of spoilt for choice. Who is your goalkeeping sub? I'm interested in that, chaps.
I think it would have been Ian Walker for me, just because, again, longevity. He was in England very, very briefly, an England goalkeeper as well.
Yes, I remember that.
So before we move on to the week that was, Gareth, why don't you just tell us the title of your book once again, when it's out, and how we can get it.
Sure. So the title of the book is Gascoigne Going to Have a Crack? It is out on the 22nd of April. Currently, the books are on a shipping container somewhere off the west coast of Namibia, and I know that because I'm tracking it on a daily basis. I've become slightly obsessed with where the shipping container is. It's due into Felixstowe on the 8th of April, and then it will go to the distribution channel. So it's available for pre-sale now. You can find it on Amazon. You can find it on Waterstones, WH Smiths. Steph, I know that you've ordered one as an international customer as well, so they are available to be shipped all around the world, probably via Amazon is your best bet for that one.
You with the shipping. It sounds a bit like my son. When we buy something from Amazon, he bothers me every 2 minutes to find out where it is. So, let's move on to the week that was, and I better take this quick as we've been talking for an hour and a quarter already. So broadcasters decided what games they want to show in the next round of fixtures, and unsurprisingly, the North London Derby is one of those games selected. It's now due to be played on Sunday the 28th of April at 2 p.m, unless Arsenal get past Bayern Munich in the Champions League, in which case it will be moved again to the lunchtime kickoff on Saturday the 27th of April. And then our game against Man City has also been moved from Saturday the 20th of April because they're playing in the FA Cup semi-finals that weekend, but we're waiting to find out when that is. So it really gets my goat when tickets go on sale and you don't know when a game's going to be played. I think we had a moan about this a few weeks ago, don't we? We were talking about kind of how fans are being treated. I assume you agree.
100%. I agree 100%. I actually know personally of 10 people who have planned a trip from here for the Man City game who now will not get to see it.
Yeah, I know a few people have been...
10?
Yeah, I know a few people have been caught by the Forest game as well. I mean, you were lucky, weren't you, Steph, with yours, because you've...
We're very lucky. I nearly got caught out, but I managed to change my ticket without a charge. But I mean, that's a rarity. You're absolutely right. We'll get into this in another pod again, I'm sure. But in short, I agree with you 100%. And I think this pod needs to start debating some solutions.
Should we be concerned about possible fixture congestion later in the season? Because we've got the City and Chelsea games still waiting to find a home. It's a potential issue, isn't it, later on?
Yeah, it is. I think unhelpfully, it gives us weekends free when, if you're not in European football, you haven't only got midweek games. That is actually more of a hindrance than a help. I think going 2 weeks without a game, as will happen before the Arsenal game now. And yeah, ultimately, that's then going to cause the backlog later on when you've got high profile games going in, and you get the feeling that the Premier League or Sky are desperate to build up this return of the Battle of the Bridge, aren't they, with Poch on the other side in the other dugout this year. So for them to be able to create a narrative around that and slot that in anywhere.
That was interesting. I think Ange spoke about that recently, where he was talking about, I think a journalist in a press conference asked him about whether he was pleased that they had a break and we weren't playing European football this year. And he was saying he prefers it when you've got a game every 3 days or so, because rotation happens naturally. When you're playing once a week or you've got 10 days or something like that, then you kind of play your best 11 and the fringe players don't get a chance. So they're colder when they're coming into the team. So, which is a point I hadn't really thought about before. You're right, Gareth, later on we've had this issue, I think, recently, haven't we, where we've had games in fits and starts, haven't we? We've had a gap and then we've got a few fixtures and a bit of a gap and a few fixtures. It doesn't really help with the rhythm.
No, I think it's a massive problem. And again, you know, it's something else to discuss on another pod at another time, because there has to be another way. There simply has to be.
Right, return to Oz. So it was confirmed a while ago that we'd be heading to Australia for a friendly at the end of the season. We now know that we're playing Newcastle at the iconic MCG on Wednesday, the 22nd of May, kicking off at 7:45 local time. There's 11 hours difference between Melbourne and London, so UK-based fans can watch the game at 8:45 a.m. I'm a little disappointed that it wasn't an afternoon kickoff, so that we could all get that experience of being a tourist in a plastic, but have to get up in the middle of the night and to support our team. And, you know, then maybe we'd be a bit more considerate and conscious before we start casting aspersions at our fellow fans. But that's that's last week's soapbox, but I thought I'd get it out one more time.
I'm standing right in front of you on that soapbox applauding.
Scott Munn and Mila Jednak were in Melbourne this week to do some promo for it, and Optus Sport carried some interviews with them on there, and they're out on their YouTube channel. Just generally, I mean, what do you think of post-season tours? Are we expecting the players in the Euros to go with that? I mean, I think it's about 3 weeks before the first fixture, so possibly they might be able to make it, but
it's such a hard question, isn't it? Because, I mean, again, there are commercial necessities in the modern game. I do think it's a long way to be going, but the juxtapose is, you know, going to Australia. I mean, they're going to our manager's home, where we have tons and tons of fans, and they get the opportunity to see the team. It's you know, I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not really sure where I sit. I see people getting very upset about it. I'm not like that at all. With regards to players who will be playing in the Euros, I mean, if it's 2 or 3 weeks until the Euros start, I don't see why they can't make the trip. By the same token, I could understand if James Maddison's like, you know, I'd really rather make sure I'm fit for England. Yeah, tough one. It's really tough.
Yeah. Well, especially if you think about players in the Euros, there's the FA Cup final after this game. So this is what, the 22nd of May. So the FA Cup final, which is likely going to involve Chelsea, Manchester City or Man U. So that's a lot of England players that will still be playing through to then. Then there's the Champions League final and the Europa League final, which will be the midweek and the week after that too. Mm-hmm. So there'll be lots of players in the Euros that will be playing well beyond the end of the season. And, you know, probably ours, I don't know what the flight times are like, but I dare say they would be back home before the FA Cup final kicks off.
Good point. Yeah. Good point. So I say, what a great place to be playing, though, and it's really good for fans over there that be able to get to see us. So
brilliant stadium, that, the MCG, by the way. It's a great stadium.
Ben Davies gave an interview on the Gab and Jules podcast this week, and amongst other things, he spoke about his plans for when he retires and confirmed a few things that we've speculated about on this pod before. So he talks about how he should have his UEFA coaching license within the next month. He talks about his studies and how he's doing a business course through the PFA, which I think he said is the equivalent of a master's. He says that when he was injured recently, he stayed at Hotspur Way rather than join some other players in Dubai so that he could watch the academy games at the training ground. And of his plans after he retires, he says that he wants to move straight into coaching. And then he goes on to say, I'm going to see how the coaching and stuff goes first. If it's up my street, then great. But I think even if I try it first, it gives me a better grounding, a better understanding of the whole industry of football from different angles. So if I then want to go on to the business side and the office side of football, then I have that option. So it's not so much more news, more of a kind of I told you so. And it's another bit of Steph bait, Steph. It says,
No, I love to see it. I mean, isn't it great to see, great players extending themselves further and wanting to learn more and hopefully being folding back into our setup? I mean, that's what you'd hope would come from this. Yeah. Like Ryan Mason, he will end up folding into our setup. And I think that adds to the culture of the club being built all the time, doesn't it? When you keep on reinvesting in that sense, it can only be good.
It's interesting when he's talking about his licenses, like the A license and stuff, and the coaching badges, because he says that what he didn't want to do is finish playing and then do his badges. And he's got a 3-year gap between finishing playing and then being able to start coaching, so he's been working on it for a while. I'd say lastly, something that I should have included in the week that was a few weeks back, but probably didn't have space or wanted to get to bed early, so I'd left it out. Last month, Spurs keeper Alfie Whiteman did a DJ set on the unknown radio station NTS. Alfie's set features soul, funk, psychedelic rock and jazz fusion with artists including David Axelrod, Cocteau Twins, Elliot Smith, Pharoah Sanders and Lonnie Liston Smith, and it ends with the Floaters 1977 classic Float On. I've listened to it. It's really good. In an interview with Fader magazine, also the Fader magazine, Alfie talks about the influence his dad had on his music taste, and how his dad took him to Roy Ayres' last ever show in London at Ronnie Scott's, and how he tries to nick some records from his dad each time he goes around to visit. Steph, I'm beginning to think there might be a bit of competition at Hotspur Way to see which player can push your buttons the most or turn you on the most. They've obviously seen that there's a vacancy now that Eric Dyer's departed. It's fantastic, isn't it?
It is fantastic. It's fantastic because I knew nothing about it until you pointed it out. So as soon as we finish recording here, I'm going to be clicking this link you've provided to this NTS live show, and I'm going to be checking it out. Sounds great. What a great taste in music what great taste in music. Yeah, I mean, you've got to say.
He clearly knows his stuff. I'll include the link in the notes to this. And I'll also include the link to the 90s pod that we did before and Gareth mentioned earlier on. So a bit of extra listening for you, some homework.
That would be great. But it makes me wonder what Vicario might listen to, how he would DJ. Would it be a bit of Giorgio Moroder in there? I don't know. Who do you think he's got to wonder? Maybe we can revisit this. We can think about what some of our players would do if they were DJs. I like this. We're getting back into music.
Yeah, I've got images now of him kind of dancing around his living room to I Feel Love. That's a nice thought, isn't it?
It is big Vic Giorgio Moroder. It makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah. Maybe he plays a little bit before he goes and trains. Maybe we'll see if we can time some of his saves with Giorgio Moroder music. Maybe you can if you're motivated. Brilliant. I always love doing this pod. I mean, we all have such a good time. This one, very, very cool. I mean, really a lot of fun. And Gareth, once again, many, many congratulations on not just the book, but the execution of an idea, which is just, a huge part of it, isn't it? Because we're going to be able to hold it, see it, read it. And you will too out there, because you will pre-order this and you will not be disappointed. Plus, you'll find out how much a flight was to, where was it?
Chisnau, yeah.
That's it. The Chisnau Travel Directive will be your knowledge to have. So fantastic. Thanks very much indeed. I think we're both thanking you. So.
Yeah, no, well done, mate.
Thank you for giving me the platform to talk about the book tonight as well, and say hopefully it will resonate with our listeners.
And thank you to Edward Sheringham for that 93rd minute flick header at Leicester City's Filbert Street back in the 90s. Next week's pod is going to be out after the West Ham game, so it is a little later than usual. We're going to miss you. We know you'll miss us, but we will be there soon after. So thanks for joining us, and we will see you after the West Ham game.